This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Hello, good morning. I'm Noel Lim. Today, I speak to Kishore Mahbubani, Distinguished Fellow at the Asia Research Institute of the National University of Singapore, NUS. He is a former diplomat and a founding dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy and also an honorary international member of the prestigious American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Kishore has also written numerous books, the latest being Has China Won? Welcome and good to have you back again. What new reality will Xi Jinping's common prosperity goal and tighter behavior regulation create for China?
We are in the middle of a great transition in China. And I suspect it's too early to tell what the lasting effects could be, because there are, as you know, two schools of thought on Xi Jinping's, common prosperity policies. The first school of thought, which is in some ways the dominant school of thought in the United States of America, is that this is great news for America. Xi Jinping is shooting himself in the foot. He's destroying capitalism in China. He's going after big tech. And guess what? America is going to win. Okay, that's one school of thought. The second school of thought is that actually, Xi Jinping is finally doing something that is absolutely necessary for Chinese society, because Chinese society was heading in the same direction as American society and becoming a plutocracy, where in the plutocracy, the big companies, especially the big tech, were too strong to be regulated by the government or by the people. And instead of the regulators controlling the big firms in the United States control the regulators. So if Xi Jinping succeeds in preventing China from becoming a plutocracy, he will actually create in China a much more competitive economy than the one that the United States has. So these are the two schools of thought. On balance, I belong to the second school of thought, that what he's doing is probably good for Chinese society and Chinese economy.
Most socialist country without democratic elections provides no checks and balances, and it does curtail citizen voices. What is the downside or potential downside of China's approach?
Well, I mean, it's true that China is not a liberal democracy like the United States, but there are, you know, different ways of suppressing the voice of the people. One is, of course, is by big government. And that's what, as you know, happens in the Soviet Union, happens in autocratic societies, happens in Communist Party-run societies. So certainly China doesn't have the kind of free speech that, say, like the United States has, right? But the other way of suppressing the voice of the common people is to have the media dominated by big money. And so it's big money that determines the agenda of what is being said. So it is not true that you only get distortions of the news only in Communist Party societies and not in a democratic societies like the United States. So, and at the end of the day, you got to watch the results, okay? And if the Chinese economy continues to produce unicorns and continues to produce entrepreneurs, then you cannot say that the system is not working, right?
But what about other things like happiness, welfare, you know, giving people that space that they need rather than having Big Brother control them? Now, I appreciate you mentioned there are many other subtle ways of controlling people, but China is taking a very obvious approach, a very tangible approach. Mm. And surely there must be some downside to this, right? At least on people's welfare, their sense of well-being.
Well, I think the best way to answer your question is to quote the views of the greatest recent American living philosopher, John Rawls. And John Rawls says that the most just society is the one you choose to be born in if you didn't know whether you're going to be born in the top 10% or in the bottom 10%. Now, if you knew you're going to be born in the top 10%, I would say I would choose to be born in the United States of America. But if you knew you're going to be born in the bottom 10%, I would say you better not be born in the United States of America, because you will lead a very grim life. And especially if you're born a black in the bottom 10% in America, your chances of spending your life in jail is more than 50%. And it is a horrible condition. It's like being in solitary confinement for 30 years. And if you look at the conditions of the bottom 10%, and even the bottom 50%, the bottom 50% in America haven't enjoyed any improvement in their standard of living for 30 years, and in fact suffered a deterioration. In fact, America is the only modern developed country where the life expectancy has gone down. And when life expectancy goes down, it's a leading indicator of what something is wrong in your society. Whereas by contrast, the bottom 50% in China have had the best 30 years in 3,000 years of Chinese history. So if you're thinking in terms of opportunities for people at the very bottom, the people at the very bottom in China have been flooded with opportunities that they've never enjoyed ever in Chinese history. Yeah, if you believe that Harvard University is an objective American university, there's a Harvard Kennedy School study produced by the Ash Institute of Governance that shows that support for the Chinese Communist Party has gone up from 86% in 2003 to 93% in 2016. This is a Harvard. So this shows that clearly that there is support for what the Chinese Communist Party is doing and what Xi Jinping is doing. I think it's also very clear, as I say in my book, that China's future also depends on his ability to manage a good succession process. And if he can manage a good succession process, even after he stays 3 or 4 terms, then he would have succeeded, you know. So it is not written in the constitution that, like in some countries, where he'll be a ruler for life.
China's plans to, you know, move towards this common prosperity, to regulate behavior, what could possibly go wrong? What is that potential downside?
Yeah, I think the success is never guaranteed. You know, the Machiavelli once famously said that there is no more dangerous thing to do in life than to launch major reforms. So I'm sure Xi Jinping is aware that it's very, very dangerous to carry out this major reform. So I think he'll do it very carefully. And of course, the biggest danger is that the capitalists in China or the entrepreneurs in China decide that China is not investor friendly and they stop investing in China. And if people stop investing in China, then the economic growth will slow down, and economic growth slows down, then China will not succeed in becoming the number one economy in the world in the next 10 years. So there are dangers for sure. I mean, there's no question whatsoever. So which means, therefore, that if he succeeds, it will be a tremendous achievement.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of Henry Kissinger's first visit to China. Now, you've advocated for more cooperation between the US and China and seeing similarities instead of differences. What role can ASEAN countries play to compel the US and China to become more collaborative?
This is the 50th anniversary of Henry Kissinger's visit to China. The establishment of contact, the normalization of relations took place in 1979, 42 years ago. And indeed, in the 1980s, US and China had a genuine honeymoon. And indeed, CIA listening stations were established on Chinese territory to listen to the Soviet Union. That's how close the collaboration was between US and China. But now we have gone from the honeymoon to the opposite of honeymoon. And that is a major geopolitical contest has broken up between the US and China. Unfortunately, it has broken up without the US working out a long-term strategy, as was confirmed to me by Henry Kissinger when I met him in 2018. So in terms of what ASEAN can do, I think it's very important for ASEAN to speak out as strongly and as loudly as it can that ASEAN wants to maintain good relations with the United States of America. And of course, the United States is a much bigger investor in ASEAN than China is cumulatively. But ASEAN also wants to maintain good relations with China. And ASEAN today does more trade with China than it does with the United States. In fact, in the year 2000, U.S. trade with China was more than three times China's trade with ASEAN, $135 billion versus $40 billion. But today, China's trade with ASEAN is more than double U.S. trade with ASEAN, is $600 billion versus $300 billion. So it's very important for ASEAN countries to come together in a united fashion and say to both U.S. and China, we love you both, don't make us choose between the two of you.
This morning, I'm speaking to Kishore Mahbubani, author of the book, Has China Won? He's a former diplomat and distinguished fellow at the Asia Research Institute of the National University of Singapore. After this, we'll discuss the implications of the recent Australia-UK-US or AUKUS alliance. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
This morning, Kishore Mahbubani joins us. He's the author of the book, Has China Won? As a former diplomat, you're no stranger to behind-the-scenes negotiations to hammer a deal that secures cooperation and one that saves the faces of the parties in conflict. How can politicians and diplomats in ASEAN move this agenda along for closer US-China cooperation, maybe start in the areas of environment?
Well, I think the number one is to make the message public that we want to have good relations with the US and good relations with China. I think that's very, very important, that we state that very loudly and very clearly, publicly, not privately, number one. So there's no misunderstanding, because many Americans, unfortunately, are under the great delusion that in secret, all the ASEAN countries want to join up with the United States and beat up China. I don't know where they get that delusion from. They're certainly suffering from that delusion. But I think privately, we should also tell the United States, and I speak here as a friend of the United States. In fact, my book is actually meant to be a gift to the United States. Why don't you press the pause button on the geopolitical contest against China and work out a long-term strategy that will benefit the American people? Because so far, what the United States has done over the last 30 years has not improved the conditions of the bottom 50% of the American people. You know, as you know, the Americans have spent $5 trillion fighting unnecessary wars since 9/11, 20 years ago. And similarly, in launching a geopolitical contest against China without working out strategy, they may be actually be damaging the interests of the American people. So what they should do is work out a different strategy whereby they compete with China, not necessarily in becoming the stronger military power, but in becoming the more admired society, becoming the society that everybody wants to go and migrate to and live and work in, rather than the one that is got a bigger military power. Because in terms of GNP, there's almost no question that within 10 to 15 years, United States will become the number two economy in the world. And so, unfortunately, in America, if you say that, you're politically dead. So the truth you cannot say in America. So we, as the friends of America, can state truths that Americans cannot state publicly. So why don't you adopt a more intelligent strategy for managing China? Because all the delusions that Americans have that they can transform China, make it into a liberal democracy, I mean, that's absolutely almost hallucinatory. But that's exactly what American policy has been for 20 years.
And how do you read the recent move to set up the AUKUS alliance of US supplying nuclear-powered technology to Australia?
All countries have the sovereign right to choose the weapons that they want to buy, you know. So Australia has the sovereign right to buy nuclear submarines, and we should not question it or challenge it. But at the same time, I think I would also remind Australia that the Soviet Union had wonderful nuclear submarines and lost the Cold War. And the reason why the Soviet Union lost is because the nature of the contests in these geopolitical games is not military, but political. and the Soviet Union didn't do a good job of cultivating its neighbors, and therefore became isolated as a result. So I would say that if I was Australia, the first question I would ask is what Australia doing similar to what its neighbors are doing or different from what its neighbors are doing? So that's what Australia should ask itself. And therefore, there's a long-term security for Australia is not going to come from nuclear submarines. It's going to come with working out a political strategy that works in harmony with that of its neighborhood.
How else should Australia now engage with ASEAN?
You know, the Vietnamese have lived with China for 2,000 years. In fact, Vietnam, I think, was occupied by China for 1,000 years. The Vietnamese say that to become a leader of Vietnam, you must be able to stand up with China, but you must also be able to get along with China. If you cannot do both, then you cannot be a leader of Vietnam. So I think similarly, Australia should also develop the same wisdom, which is to become the leader of Australia, you must be able to stand up to China, but you must also be able to get along with China. And if you cannot do both, then you cannot be a leader of Australia.
With this AUKUS alliance coming in place, how must ASEAN re-engage with Western powers and China?
Well, as you know, ASEAN is always the most underestimated organization in the whole world. And that's why I wrote a book called The ASEAN Miracle, which has been actually published in Malaysia in Bahasa Melayu, by the way. So it's available in translation. I think it's better for ASEAN to continue to take a low profile and not grandstand and make big statements. But in its own quiet way, ASEAN is maintaining good relations with China, and ASEAN is maintaining good relations with the United States. At a time when most countries have difficulty maintaining a balance. So ASEAN, I would say, is walking a tightrope and doing it very quietly and doing it very well. And lots of countries can learn lessons from ASEAN.
You've said you are a friend of US, but there are people who accuse you of being a fanboy of China. What would you say in your defense?
Very simple. I mean, my first book was called Can Asians Think? So the Asians who accuse me of being a fanboy of China, I would say, why don't you start thinking for a change? Because if I was an enemy of the United States, I would actually encourage the United States to carry on with its current policies towards China, because they're designed to fail. If you launch a contest without a strategy, you're bound to fail. So by contrast, I'm the one who is actually a friend of the United States and saying that, why don't you press the pause button, work out a strategy, think what your long-term strategic goals are, make it your priority to improve the well-being of the American people. And I am actually giving advice on how to improve the well-being of the American people using the advice of an American philosopher, so John Rawls. So, you know, the point is, the interesting thing is, you know, I'll just give you one example. There's a man called Professor Lawrence Summers. He's the former Treasury Secretary, former president of Harvard University. He was asked in a Bloomberg interview in early 2021, which are the three best books he had read in 2020. He mentioned Obama's memoirs. He mentioned a book by a Nobel laureate, Angus Deaton. And he mentioned Has China Won by Kishore Mahbubani. So obviously, Larry Summers is not pro-China. He's pro-America. So he read my book very carefully, and he saw that my book is trying to help the United States of America.
I appreciate it's difficult for the CCP or the Chinese Communist Party to steer a big ship like China. How can it deal with dissent without coming across as a hardliner? Now, when I say this, what comes to mind are the Uyghurs, the Hong Kong demonstrators, and the complete removal of the internet footprint of influencers. That seems very extreme.
Well, you know, I'm known for speaking out hard truths, right? And in the final chapter of my book, I discussed the United States call on the Islamic world to stand up and defend the Uyghurs in China, right? It is wiser not to pass judgments on other societies without looking into what you yourself have done. And as you know, when you deal with countries, it's often wiser if you have concerns to raise them in private to try, if you want to have change. The question is, do you want to do good or do you want to feel good? So if you want to feel good, criticize China publicly and nothing will change. If you want to feel, if you want to do good, then you talk to China privately and maybe things will change. And as you know, in the one of the oldest Western principles of justice is that you got to be fair. So if you're going to criticize China for doing, for let's say, torturing Uyghurs, then frankly, as a European country, you should also criticize the United States for torturing people in Guantanamo Bay. But you notice that not one European government criticized the United States. So all these double standards, which I have documented for 30 years, undermine the moral credibility of the West when they speak out on this issue. So I suggest a wiser course of action, which is to try and work quietly behind the scenes, use diplomacy rather than use the grandstanding microphone to try and effect change.
Is there room for China to take a higher ground?
Well, I think for the next 20 or 30 years, China will be preoccupied still. We're trying to convert China into a moderately prosperous society. You know, right now they have succeeded in eradicating poverty, but they have their per capita income is 10,000 compared to 65,000 for the United States. So I think if China wants to focus itself on this internal development, we should allow China to do so. And the fact that China has no ambition to step into America's shoes to try and run the world, that is actually good for the world. So let China be China.
Well, Kishore, it's always a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time. Kishore Mahbubani, former diplomat and distinguished fellow at the Asia Research Institute of the National University of Singapore. I'm Noelle Lim on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.